You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a reading of the essays of Rudolf Steiner that were introductions to Goethe's scientific writings, entitled Nature's Open Secret. This is chapter 16, entitled Goethe as Thinker and Researcher. Part 1, entitled Goethe and Modern Science. The following pages might never have been written if a feeling of obligation to speak honestly did not arise when one has the sense of having recognized the truth. Given the current direction of natural science, I have no doubt about how they will be judged by professionals in the field. These pages will be described as a dilettante's attempt to reopen an issue long ago resolved by those, quote, in the know, close quote. When I consider the derogatory opinions of those who have a say in the matter, I must admit that the prospect is not very tempting. Nevertheless, I cannot shrink from the anticipation of such arguments, because I could make them myself. Consequently, I know how little validity they have. Thinking, in quotes, scientifically, in the sense of modern science, is really not that difficult. A rather remarkable case in point was the recent publication of Edward von Hartmann's titled Philosophy of the Unconscious. The spirited author of this book would be the last one to deny its imperfections. But the quality of thinking we encounter there gets right to the bottom of matters. Consequently, it left a strong impression on all those who feel the need for deeper insight. It proved frustrating, however, to the more superficial scholars of natural science, who generally opposed it. When those attacks remained relatively unsuccessful, an anonymous author published titled The Unconscious from the Perspective of Philosophy and the Theory of Descent, 1872. Its author strongly criticized the new philosophy, raising every argument that could be used against it from the perspective of contemporary natural science. The book created a stir, and scholars were quite satisfied. They claimed both the author and his arguments as their own. But then, to their great disappointment, the author turned out to be none other than Hartmann himself. This provides convincing proof of one thing. When seriously striving people still find it impossible to ally themselves with the latest trends, it is not through ignorance of scientific research or because they are amateurs. It is because they understand that the paths those trends follow are the wrong ones. It is not difficult for philosophy to consciously adopt the position of contemporary science. Hartmann has irrefutably demonstrated this to anyone willing to look. I mention this to corroborate my previous statement, that I would have no trouble formulating the very objections others might raise to what I have said. Presently, it seems that anyone who gives serious consideration to philosophical thinking on the nature of things is considered a dilettante. Simply having a worldview at all is seen as an idealistic whim by our contemporaries of a mechanistic, or better yet, a positivistic, conviction. It is easy to understand this opinion when we see how hopeless the ignorance of these positivist thinkers is, when we hear them speak of the, quote, nature of matter, close quote, the, quote, frontiers of knowledge, quote, the, quote, nature of the atom, close quote, and so on. Such discourse provides ample opportunity to study their amateur approach to fundamental scientific matters. We must have the courage to admit all this vis-à-vis contemporary natural science, despite the powerful, admirable achievements of that same natural science in the realm of technology. Such technical achievements have nothing to do with any real desire to understand nature. We have seen this in our contemporaries whose inventions have a significance for the future we can barely begin to assess, but who also lack a deep scientific yearning. It is one thing to observe the processes of nature with the purpose of utilizing its forces for technology. And it is quite another to study those processes with the purpose of understanding their nature more deeply. True science exists only when the inquiring spirit seeks the satisfaction of its own needs with no external purpose. True science, in the highest sense of the word, deals with objective ideas. It can be nothing but idealism, because it is rooted ultimately in spiritual needs. Nature awakens questions in us that demand resolution, but it cannot deliver the answers itself. Such new challenges arise when nature is confronted by a higher realm through our capacity for knowledge. Such questions would not even arise for a being not possessed of this higher nature. Consequently, answers can be obtained only through this higher nature itself. Scientific questions are thus primarily a matter that the inquiring spirit has to settle with itself. They do not lead the spirit beyond its own realm. But the realm in which the spirit is at home, and where it lives and weaves, is the world of ideas and thinking. Scientific activity, in the highest sense of the word, means dealing with questions that arise in thinking through answers conceived in thought. Ultimately, the function of any scientific endeavor is to serve this higher purpose. Consider scientific observation. It is supposed to lead us to an understanding of a natural law, which is itself of a purely ideal nature. The urge to look for a governing lawfulness behind the phenomena arises from the spirit. Only a spiritual being would feel this urge. As for observation, what are we really trying to accomplish through it? Can sensory observations actually find answers to questions forged by the spirit? Not at all. After all, why should a second observation give us more satisfaction than the first, if spirit could actually be satisfied with the observed object? One observation should be enough. But it is not really a question of a second observation. Rather, it is one of finding the ideal basis for the observations. The question is, what ideal explanation does the observation allow? How do I need to think so that it seems possible? These are the questions that come to us when we encounter the sensory world. I must pull up from the depths of my spirit what I find lacking in the world of the senses. When I encounter the sensory realm, I must myself create the higher nature toward which my spirit strives. Nothing else can do it for me. Because the results of science can come only from the spirit, they must be ideas. This arises from its own necessity and is indisputable. It confirms the idealistic character of all science. Modern natural science, by its very laws, cannot believe that knowledge is characterized by ideas. It views ideas not as the first, most creative, it views ideas not as the first, most original, creative agencies, but rather as the final product of material processes. Science is unaware that those material processes belong to the world we can observe through our senses, which nevertheless resolves itself into idea when understood more deeply. The process to be observed is as follows. Through our senses, we perceive facts which proceed according to mechanical laws. Then, manifestations of warmth, light, magnetism, electricity, and finally life processes and such. At the highest level of life, we find that it rises to forming concepts or ideas carried by the brain, human brain. Emerging from this realm of thought, we find our own I, capital. This seems to be the highest product of a complicated process mediated through a long sequence of physical, chemical, and organic events. But when we investigate the world of ideas, the essence of the I, we find much more than merely the end product of this process. We find that the individual aspects of this thought world are related in a completely different way than are the parts of the process we merely observed. As a thought arises in us, and in turn calls for another, we find that there is an ideal relationship between those two thoughts, which is of a very different nature from the relationship I observe, for example, between the dyeing of a piece of cloth and the chemical agent that causes it. It is completely natural that the successive stages of the neural process in the brain have their sources in the metabolism, and that it is the metabolism itself that sustains my thought. In that metabolism, however, we will not discover why one thought should follow from another. This can be found only in the logical relationship between the thoughts themselves. The realm of thoughts, therefore, is governed not only by organic necessity, but also by a necessity of a higher, ideal nature. The spirit, however, looks for the same ideal necessity that it finds in its world of ideas, in the rest of the universe as well. This necessity arises for us only because we do not merely observe, but also think. In other words, whenever we apprehend things, not only through observation, but also through thinking, they no longer appear to us merely in terms of their factual relationships. They are also related through an inner, ideal necessity. One cannot object to this by asking whether there is any point in trying to comprehend the sensory world through thinking, if the things of this world, by their very nature, do not allow such comprehension. This question can be asked only when we have failed to get to the core of the matter. The world of ideas springs to life within us, encounters the objects we perceive through the senses, and asks, what is the relationship between me and the world facing me? What is that world in relation to me? Here I am, with my ideal necessity that rises above transient reality. Within me, I have the power to explain myself, but how can I explain what I encounter outside of me? This is where we find an answer to the significant question repeatedly brought up, for example, by Friedrich Theodor Fischer, 1807 to 1887, who described it as the pivotal point of all philosophical thinking. It is the question of the relationship between spirit and nature. What is the relationship between these two forms of being that seem separate? If this question is asked in the right way, it is not as difficult to answer as one might think. After all, what can it mean? It is not as though the question were asked by a third party who is trying to understand from a vantage point above both spirit and nature. Rather, it is asked by one of those two beings, by the spirit itself. The spirit wants to discover the relationship between itself and nature. This is the same as asking how I can establish a relationship with the nature that I encounter. And how can I express this connection in a way that accords with the needs that live in me? I live in ideas. What kind of idea corresponds to nature? How do I express as idea what I contemplate as nature? It is as if we often blocked the way to a satisfactory answer by asking the wrong question. But the correct question is half the answer. The spirit searches everywhere for a way to transcend the sequence of facts given by mere observation and tries to penetrate to the ideas of things. Science begins where thinking begins. What appears to our senses as a sequence of facts is expressed as ideal necessity by the results of science. Those results only appear to be the final product of the process described above. In fact, we must consider them to be the foundation of everything in the entire universe. Where they appear for our observation is a matter of indifference, because their significance is independent of where we observe them. The net of their ideal necessity spreads over the whole universe. We can begin anywhere. Ultimately, we will get to the idea if we have enough spiritual strength. Inasmuch as modern physics fails to recognize this, it is led into a whole sequence of mistakes. Let me point out one such error as an example. Consider the definition of what is typically described by physicists as one of the, quote, common characteristics of bodies, close quote, the principle of inertia. It is usually stated as follows. No object can change its current state of motion except as the result of an external cause. This definition creates the impression that the concept of an inert body has been abstracted from the world of the senses. And John Stuart Mill, who never investigates this question but turns everything on its head to prove an arbitrary theory, would not for a moment hesitate to explain it this way. Nevertheless, it is incorrect. The concept of an inert body arises purely through a conceptual construct. In calling anything that extends in space a, in quotes, body, I can think of some bodies that undergo changes through external influences, and others that move on their own initiative. Consequently, if I find something in the external world that fits my definition of, quote, bodies that cannot change without an external cause, close quote, I call it inert, that is, subject to the law of inertia. My concepts are not abstracted from the sensory world, but constructed autonomously from an idea. And only with the help of this idea can I orient myself in the sensory world. The definition would therefore have to be stated this way. A body that cannot itself change the state of its movement is inert. Once I have found a body that fits this definition, I can apply everything that applies to an inert body to the one I have found. Part 2, titled The Archetypal Phenomenon. If we were able to follow the whole series of events that take place whenever there is a sensory perception, from the peripheral nerve ends to the sensory organ, all the way to the brain, we would still not reach the point where the mechanical, chemical, and organic, the time-space, processes cease, and where something occurs that we can call sensory perception, sensation of warmth, light, sound, and so on. Nowhere do we find a point of transition from causal movement to its effect, the perception. Can we then describe the relationship between these aspects as cause and effect? Let us look objectively at the matter. Let us assume that a particular sensation arises in our consciousness. It arises in such a way that it calls our attention to an object from which it originates. When I have the sensation of red, the content of my mental representation of red allows me to immediately connect it with a particular spatial coordinate, that is, a space or surface, to which I then ascribe the sensation. The only time this does not occur is when the sensory organ itself responds in its own way to an external influence, such as the sensation of light in response to a sudden pressure on the eye. We need not be concerned here with such instances, because they lack the characteristics of normal perception, and such exceptions will not show us anything about the nature of this perception. If I have a sensation of red in connection with a particular location, my attention will initially be directed to some object in the outer world as the source of that sensation. I might ask about spatial-temporal processes taking place in the thing I associate with the color red, And it will turn out that mechanical, chemical, and other processes present themselves as answers to my questions. I can proceed to investigate the processes that mediate the color red for me on the way from the thing to my sensory organ. Here, too, the only mediators I will be able to find are movement processes, electrical currents, and chemical changes. The results would be no different if I were able to investigate the further transmission from the sensory organ to its corresponding center in the brain. What is transmitted along this entire path is the perception of red. How this perception presents itself in any particular thing that happens to lie along the way from stimulation to perception depends, of course, on the nature of that thing. The sensation is present in each place, from the initial stimulus to the brain, though never explicitly as such, but in the way that corresponds to the nature of the object that happens to be in that place. This reveals a truth well suited to illuminate the whole theoretical foundation of physics and physiology. What do I learn by investigating something involved in a process that enters my consciousness as a sensation? All I really learn is how that particular thing responds to the action that proceeds from the sensation. In other words, the way a sensation expresses itself in a particular object of the world of space and time. Far from being the cause that initiates the sensation within me, the spatial-temporal process is the effect of the sensation in a thing that exists in space and time. I could include any number of things along the path from the stimulus to the organ of perception. Each will respond in a way that is both determined and limited by its own nature. It is thus the sensation itself that expresses itself in each of the processes. The transmission of sound involves longitudinal vibrations of the air. The transmission of light involves hypothetical ether vibrations. Both forms are simply the particular way those specific sensations are able to manifest in a medium that by its very nature is capable only of rarefaction and condensation, in other words, of oscillation. The sensation itself cannot be found in this medium because it cannot exist there. Such processes, however, cannot be said to embody the objective nature of the sensation, but rather a form in which it manifests. Footnote: in a later section, Steiner compares the transmission of sense perceptions to the transmission of a telegram. See page 189, editor, and a footnote. Now let us ask, what is the nature of those mediating processes? Besides, through our senses, is there any other means by which we can investigate them? Can I really study my senses using anything but the senses themselves? Are the peripheral nerve endings or brain convolutions anything other than sensory perceptions? All these things are at the same time both subjective and objective, assuming, of course, that the distinction is even tenable. We can now approach the matter somewhat more precisely. As we follow perception from stimulus to an organ of perception, we are really studying a continuous transition from one perception to another. The perception of red caused us to begin the whole process in the first place, and it points us toward the stimulus. Once we look there, we find other sensations related to red. They are movement processes, and these in turn appear as other movement processes between the stimulus and the sensory organ, and so on. All of these, however, are perceived sensations as well. All of it is a metamorphosis of events, that insofar as they are accessible to sensory observation at all, reveal themselves as nothing but perceptions. The perceived world is nothing other than an aggregate of metamorphosed perceptions. For the sake of convenience, we have expressed ourselves in a way that cannot be reconciled completely with these conclusions. We said that each, in quotes, thing that inserts itself into the gap between the stimulus and the perceptual organ evokes a sensation that corresponds to its nature. Strictly speaking, of course, the thing is really the sum of the processes that constitute its appearance. People will now argue that these conclusions preclude any sense of permanence in the ongoing world process. Like Heraclitus, we claim that the sole principle of the world is the continuous flow of things where nothing is permanent. Surely there must be a, in quotes, thing in itself behind all appearances. There must be, in quotes, permanent matter behind this world of changes. We must therefore take another look at the question of permanent matter, or, in quotes, duration in change. When my eye is confronted by a red surface, a sensation of red appears in my consciousness. We can distinguish the beginning, middle, and end of that sensation. In contrast to this transient sensation, we wish to find an enduring, objective process, one that is likewise objectively limited in time, that is, one with a beginning, middle, and end. But this process is supposed to be happening in relation to a material basis which has neither beginning nor end, which is indestructible and eternal. This matter is supposed to be the truly permanent element in these fluctuating processes. Such a conclusion might be valid if the concept of time were applied correctly to the sensation. But perhaps we need to distinguish clearly between the essence or content of the sensation itself and its appearance. They are one and the same for my perception, of course, because without its essence, the sensation would not appear to me at all. Now, from the perspective of this essence, does it make any difference whether it enters my consciousness at a particular moment and then leaves it seconds later? The essence of the sensation, its objective existence, is independent of all that. What sense, then, does it make to claim that something, that is permanent matter, is fundamental to the existence of a sensation if it has nothing to do with its essential nature? Neither is our application of the concept of time correct in relation to an objective process that begins and ends. If something acquires a new characteristic that develops for a while in various ways, then disappears, the content or quality of that characteristic would in this case also have to be regarded as its essence. This essential quality would in itself have absolutely nothing to do with the concepts of beginning, duration, and end. By, in quotes, essential, we are speaking of what actually makes something what it is, or the way it presents itself. The important thing is not the fact that something emerges at a particular moment in time, but what it is that actually emerges. All the particular qualities that express themselves through this, in quotes, what, make up the essential being of the world. Now this what manifests under manifold conditions and in the most diverse forms. All these forms are interrelated. They create the conditions for one another. The nature of their relationship thus becomes one of separation in space and time. The concept of matter arose only because of a very misguided concept of time. The general belief is that the world would evaporate into a mere apparition without being if we did not anchor the totality of fleeting events in a permanent, immutable reality that endures in time while its various individual configurations change. But time is not a container within which changes occur. Time does not exist before things or outside of them. It is the tangible expression of the fact that events, because of their specific nature, form sequential interrelationships. Let us imagine a complex of sense-perceptible facts, A1, B1, C1, D1, E1, and another complex, A2, B2, C2, D2, E2, that depends on the first by virtue of internal necessity. I can understand the specific nature of the second complex by deriving it conceptually from the first. We have thus far described these complexes according to their essence, irrespective of time and space. Now, let us imagine that both complexes actually appear. If A2 minus E2, or excuse me, if A2 through E2 is to appear, then A1 through E1 must also appear, but in such a way that their necessary relationship is visible. This means that the phenomena A1 through E1 must be present first and allow for the phenomena A2 through E2, after which the latter can appear. From this we see that time arises only when the being of something manifests externally. Time thus belongs to the world of appearances and has nothing to do with the being or essence of a thing. Such being can be apprehended only as an idea. Only those who are unable in their own thinking to trace the appearance back to its essential being will conceive of time as preceding the facts. But then they require some kind of existence that endures throughout all changes, which they find in the concept of indestructible matter. Thus they create something impervious to time, that persists unchanged by fluctuations. But this merely emphasizes their inability to penetrate from the time-bound appearance of a fact to its essential timeless being. Can I truthfully say of the essence of a thing that it arises and then ceases? I can say only that its essence relates to the essence of something else, and that the resulting relationship appears as a chronological sequence. The essence of a thing is indestructible. It is beyond all time, and in fact determines time. We have thus elucidated two rarely understood subjects, manifestation or appearance, and being or essential nature. When we understand what has been explained here, we will not try to prove the indestructibility of the essence of a thing, because destruction implies the concept of time, which has nothing to do with the essential nature of things. Consequently, we can say that the sense-perceptible world, as it presents itself to us, is an aggregate of metamorphosing perceptions without an underlying material substratum. Footnote: based on these considerations, it should be clear now that the essential nature of phenomena may be seen as their enduring element and true foundation. Consequently, there is no need to look further for such a foundation in a hypothetical material substratum. Editor, end of footnote. Our remarks have also shown that we cannot speak of a subjective nature of perceptions. When we perceive something, we can follow the process from stimulus to central organ, but nowhere do we find a point at which we can observe a leap from the objectivity of what has not yet been perceived to the subjective perception. This refutes the idea that the sense-perceptible world is subjective. The world of perception is rooted in itself and is initially unrelated to either subject or object. These considerations pertain only to the concept of matter as the foundation of physics, identified with the old, equally incorrect, metaphysical concept of substance. It is one thing to view matter as the actual reality underlying phenomena, and another entirely to apprehend matter as phenomenon or appearance. Our considerations are directed only toward the first and do not pertain to the second. If I consider matter to be merely something that occupies space, then for me it refers only to a phenomenon with no greater reality than any other phenomenon. I just have to keep this characteristic of matter in mind. The object of all science is the world that presents itself to us through perceptions, that is, as extension, movement, rest, force, light, warmth, color, sound, electricity, and so on. If the perceived world were such that its essence was expressed fully through its sensory appearance, in other words, if everything that appeared to us were a perfect, undisturbed manifestation of its inner being, we would not need science at all, because understanding would arise in the very act of perception. Indeed, there would be no difference at all between essential being and phenomenal appearance. They would coincide completely. This is not the case, however. Imagine that element A in the world of facts has a certain relationship to element B. According to our considerations, both are phenomena and nothing more. Their relationship thus also manifests as a phenomenon, which we will call C. What we can ascertain in the factual world is the relationship between A, B, and C. But there are countless other elements, just like A, B, and C, in the perceptible world. Let's take a fourth at random, D. Once it is added, everything else is modified by its presence. Instead of A and B producing C, the presence of D will lead to the appearance of yet another phenomenon, E. The main point here is that whenever we approach a phenomenon, we see it as it has been modified by numerous conditions. Before we can understand it, we must look for all of these relationships. There are all sorts of connections, some closer, some more remote. If phenomenon E is to appear to me, other more or less connected phenomena must come into play. Some are essential to the existence of the phenomenon. The absence of others could not prevent some such phenomenon from arising, but they would affect the particular way it arises. Accordingly, we must distinguish between the necessary and incidental conditions of a phenomenon. Phenomena that arise only through the effects of necessary conditions can be called primal phenomena, the others derived phenomena. If knowing their conditions allows us to understand the primal phenomena, then by including other conditions we can understand the derived phenomena as well. Thus the task of science is to gain such a deep understanding of the phenomenal world that it finds phenomena that depend only on necessary conditions. The conceptual expressions of those necessary relationships are natural laws. Whenever we approach a particular field of phenomena, we must first describe and record them, and then we must establish which elements have a necessary connection. These elements are the archetypal phenomena. Then we must find the conditions that are related in a more remote way to those elements, and discover how they modify the original phenomena. Science views the phenomenal world as follows. All phenomena are actually derived and thus initially incomprehensible. To understand the interrelationships among phenomena, science views archetypal phenomena as leading the way, and derived phenomena as following from them. The scientific system is different from nature's system to the degree that science establishes the relationships among phenomena, thereby making them intelligible. Science need not contribute anything to the phenomenal world, but only uncover its hidden relationships. Use of the intellect should be limited to this work. The intellect and all scientific endeavors reach beyond their rightful domain when they resort to the imperceptible to explain the perceptible. Before we can understand Goethe's theory of color, we must understand the absolute correctness of these concepts. There could be nothing farther from Goethe's mind than to speculate on what the nature of a phenomenon, warmth, light, and so on, might be other than the essence of its appearance. He recognized the appropriate task of thinking. According to Goethe, light was given as a sensation. When he was trying to explain the connection between light and color, he could not do so through speculation, but only through an archetypal phenomenon, by looking for the necessary conditions that light must encounter before color can arise. Newton, too, saw that color arises in relation to light, but he went on to speculate. How does color come from light? To do so lay in his speculative way of thinking, but not in Goethe's thinking, which immersed itself in the phenomena and correctly understood its own task. To Goethe, Newton's assumption that, quote, light is made of colored lights, close quote, seemed to be a product of invalid speculation. He felt justified in speaking of the relationship between light and color only when certain conditions were given, but not in speaking of light itself by introducing a speculative concept. Hence his statement, quote, light is the simplest, least fragmented, most homogeneous being known to us. It is not by nature a composite. Close quote. Footnote. Compare Steiner's statements on Goethe's conception of light in his discourse on, quote, Goethe, Newton, and the Physics, close quote, pages 188 and 189, end of footnote. Anything said about the composition of light is a statement of the intellect about a phenomenon. But the proper domain of the intellect is limited to statements about the interrelationships of phenomena. This reveals more deeply why Goethe, when he looked at light through a prism, could not accept Newton's theory. The prism should have been the first condition for the appearance of color. But another factor, the presence of darkness, proved to be a more primary condition for its occurrence. The prism was only a secondary condition. I believe this should remove all obstacles for the reader who wishes to understand Goethe's work on color. The great scientific value of Goethe's theory of colors would have been recognized long ago if people had not repeatedly assumed that the difference between these two theories involved conflicting interpretations, the validity of which merely needs to be tested. Those who continue to accept the contemporary view of physics on this issue have been completely won over by the fundamentally false notion that it is necessary, through intellectual reasoning, to trace perceptions back to their underlying cause. But the moment one sees that the way to explain phenomena is to observe them in a context established by understanding, one must accept Goethe's theory of color in principle, because it begins with a correct view of the relationship between our thinking and nature. Newton did not share this view. Of course, I do not intend to defend every aspect of Goethe's theory of color. I do, however, want to uphold its principle. But it also cannot be my task here to use Goethe's principle to deduce color phenomena that were unknown during his time. I would undertake such a task only if I was one day fortunate enough to have the time and means to write a theory of color along the lines of Goethe's principle and based entirely on the most recent research. I would consider it one of the most rewarding works of my life. This introduction has to restrict itself to a scientific justification of Goethe's way of thinking in his theory of color. In the next section, I will clarify its inner architecture. Part 3, entitled The System of Natural Science. It might seem as though by limiting the task of thinking to the ordering of perceptions, Our investigations are now calling into question the very autonomy of concepts and ideas, which we advocated so strongly to begin with. Further reflection will show that this is not the case after all. What is the goal of thinking when it establishes connections between perceptions? Imagine perception A and perception B. Initially, they are given to us as entities devoid of concepts. The qualities offered to my senses cannot be transformed into anything else through conceptual thinking. Nor can I find any conceptual quality that would allow me to construct what is given by sensory experience if I could not access it through perception. For example, there is no way for me to communicate the quality red to a colorblind person, no matter how I describe it conceptually. There is an aspect of the sensory perception that never enters into the concept. Something that must be experienced before it can become an object of cognition at all. So what is the role of the concept that we attach to a sensory perception? Clearly, it must contribute something entirely new, something that stands on its own, yet also belongs to that sensory perception, but without ever appearing in the perception itself. Now, it is certainly true that this new, in quotes, something that the concept brings to the sensory perception is precisely what meets our need for explanation. Only then can we understand an element of the sensory world when we have a concept of it. We can always point to whatever sensory reality offers us, and anyone who has the ability to perceive it will know exactly what it is. The concept allows us to say something about the sensory world that cannot be perceived. This makes it clear that if the essence of a perception were fully expressed in the sensory quality, the concept would be unable to add anything new. Thus, the sensory perception is incomplete and constitutes only one aspect, the one that can only be seen. Only through the concept do we understand what it is we are seeing. Now we can formulate the significance of the content of what was developed methodically in the previous section. What something in the sensory world is appears only when we understand it conceptually. We cannot express the content of what we observe because its entire content is given in how it appears, in the form of its appearance. Thus we find the what, the other content of what is given in the sense world, in the concept. The world thus attains its full content only through concepts. But we have found that the concept points beyond the individual phenomenon to the interrelatedness of things. The separate and isolated appearances of sensory reality present themselves to the concept as a unified whole. Thus, our scientific methodology itself leads to the ultimate goal of a monistic natural science. But this is not an abstract monism that presumes a unity and then simply includes the individual facts of concrete existence. Rather, it is a concrete monism that shows step by step how the apparent multiplicity of sensory existence ultimately reveals itself as a unity in the realm of idea. Such a multiplicity is merely a form in which the unified essence of the world expresses itself. The senses adhere to the multiplicity, since they are unable to comprehend this unified content. They are inherently pluralists. Thinking, however, overcomes multiplicity and gradually works its way back to the unified world principle. The particular way a concept, idea, manifests in the sensory world accounts for the differentiation of the natural kingdoms. When a sense-perceptible entity attains only an existence that is completely outside the concept, in other words, If the concept governs only as a law that determines its modifications, we call that entity inorganic. Everything that happens to such an entity can be traced back to the influences of another entity, and how the two interact can be explained by an external law. In this sphere, we are dealing with phenomena and laws, which, if they are primal, may be called archetypal phenomena. The concept to be apprehended in this case lies outside the perceived multiplicity. But a sense-perceptible unity may also point beyond itself and force us, when we try to understand it, to look for determining factors beyond what is perceptible. Then, what we comprehend as concept appears as a sense-perceptible unity. These two, concept and percept, are not identical, but the concept appears as a principle within the sensory multiplicity instead of existing outside it as a law. We find the concept at the foundation of the phenomenon. It permeates the phenomenon, but is no longer perceptible to the senses. This is what we call a type. We are now in the domain of organic science. But here, also, the concept still appears only as the type, and not yet in its own form as concept. Where the type appears not just as such as an inherent principle, but in its conceptual form, it appears as consciousness. What existed at lower levels only as being now finally reveals itself. The concept itself can now be perceived. This is the domain of the cognizing human being. Natural law, type, and concept are the three forms of the idea. Natural law is an abstraction standing above the multiplicity. It governs inorganic science. Here, idea and sensory reality are completely separate. The type combines both into one being. Spirit becomes active being, but it is not yet active as such, nor is it present as such. To be observed in its actual existence, it must be perceived in its sense-perceptible form. This is what we find in organic nature. The concept is present in a form that can be perceived. In human consciousness, the concept itself is perceptible. Observation and idea coincide. We actually perceive the idea. This also allows us to see the inner principles of the lower levels of nature. Human consciousness allows us to perceive the fully manifested reality of what only exists but does not appear at lower levels. Part 4, this entitled The System of Goethe's Color Theory. Goethe lived at a time when there was a universal and powerful striving toward an absolute knowledge that finds its satisfaction in itself. It was a time when an ardent quest for deeper insight was again undertaken to explore every approach to knowledge and discover answers to the most significant questions. The age of Eastern theosophy, Plato and Aristotle, then that of Descartes and Spinoza, had been epochs of a similar inner deepening. Goethe is inconceivable without Kant, Fichte, Schelling, and Hegel. Whereas all those individuals shared a profound vision, their eyes raised to the heights, Goethe's own contemplation was focused on matters of immediate reality. But in his attentive gaze, we find some of that depth. Goethe exercised this deeper sight in his observation of nature. The spirit of his time imbued his observations of nature with an inner life. And this is what gives power to his observation of details, which is always animated by a broader view. Goethe's science always focuses on questions of central significance. We notice this especially in Goethe's theory of color. Besides his essay on the metamorphosis of plants, this is his only scientific work that has become a complete whole. And what a powerful, self-contained system it is, conceived according to the nature of the subject itself. Let us look at its internal structure. There is a prerequisite to the appearance of anything rooted in the being of nature. There must be an enabling cause, an organ in which the thing can present itself. The eternal, immutable laws of nature would always remain in force, even if no human beings were present to picture them. But they could not manifest. They would be there in being, but would not manifest. This is also true of light and color, in the absence of a perceiving eye, EYE. We cannot, like Schopenhauer, assume that colors owe their existence to the eye. Nevertheless, we must find the possibility of perceiving colors in the eye. The eye does not determine color, but causes it to appear. This is where the theory of color comes in. It must examine the eye to discover its nature. This is why Goethe begins his work with a physiological theory of color. But his conception is very different from what is ordinarily understood in this area of optics. He does not try to understand the eye's function in terms of its physical structure, but observes the eye under various conditions to understand its characteristics and capacities. Goethe's process is always one of observation. For example, what is the effect of light and darkness on the eye? What happens when it encounters definite images? And so on. He does not begin by asking what processes occur within the eye when perception takes place. Rather, he tries to get to the bottom of what actually happens in the eye in the living activity of seeing. For his purposes, this is the only important question to start with. Strictly speaking, the other does not belong to a physiological theory of color, but to the science of the human organism, or general physiology. Goethe is interested in the eye only to the extent that it sees, not in any explanation of sight derived from observing an eye that is dead. From here, he proceeds to the objective processes through which color phenomena arise. Here we must remember that when Goethe thinks of objective processes, he is not at all interested in hypothetical, imperceptible material processes or movements. He always limits himself to the perceptible world. His physical theory of color, which is the second part of his study, looks for the conditions related to color as it is produced independently of the eye. Nevertheless, he remains interested only in actual perceptions. Here he is looking at the way colors appear through a prism, a lens, and so on. For the time being, he is satisfied with following the colors as they occur, observing color as such as it arises, independent of objects. Only in a separate chapter on the chemical theory of color does Goethe proceed to colors that are fixed or, in quotes, attached to an object. The physiological theory of color answers the question of how colors appear at all, and the physical theory of color deals with the external conditions of their manifestation. Now he answers the question of how the world of objects appears colored. Thus, Goethe advances from observing color as an attribute of the phenomenal world to a study of the phenomenal world itself as it appears with this attribute. In his chapter on the sensory moral effects of color, he then finally proceeds to the observation of the higher relationship between the colored physical world and the world of the human soul. This is the rigorous, strict path of science, going from the subject as condition back to the subject as it finds its satisfaction in and with the world. The impulse of the age that led to the architecture of Hegel's whole system is obvious in this path, moving from subject to object and back again. In this sense, we must view the title Sketch of a Color Theory as Goethe's main optical work. His two essays, titled Contribution to Optics and titled Elements of a Color Theory, may be seen as preliminary studies. Titled Exposing Newton's Theory is only a polemical supplement to his work. Part 5, entitled Goethe's Concept of Space. To fully understand Goethe's work in physics, we will need to develop his concept of space. Prerequisite for comprehending this concept are convictions inherent in the previous section. First, phenomena that appear in our experience as isolated events are inwardly interrelated. In fact, they are connected by a bond of unity that encompasses the whole world. One principle lives in all of them. Second, whenever we approach separate things and attempt to connect them by determining their interrelationships, the conceptual unity we create is not external to those objects, but drawn from the very core of nature's being itself. As a process, human knowledge does not take place outside of things. It is not purely subjective and arbitrary. Rather, what arises in our spirit as natural law, what comes to life in our soul, is the very heartbeat of the universe. For our present purposes, we will examine the most external of all the connections that our spirit establishes among objects of experience. We will look at the simplest instance through which experience calls upon our spiritual activity. Imagine two simple elements of the phenomenal world. To make things as simple as possible, let us imagine two points of light. Disregard completely the fact that each of these points of light could represent a phenomenon of awesome complexity that would pose a great challenge to the mind. Also forget about their sensory qualities, and consider only the simple fact of two separate elements, that is, separate as far as our senses tell us. There are two factors, each of which is affecting our senses. This is all we are predicating. We will also say that the existence of one of these factors does not exclude the existence of the other. They can both be perceived by one perceptual organ. If we assumed that the existence of one of these elements depends in any way on the existence of the other, we would be confronted by a very different problem. If the existence of B is such that it excludes the existence of A, and yet depends on it for its existence, this implies that they are connected in terms of time. For if the existence of B depends on A, and if the presence of B precludes that of A, then A must precede B. But that is another matter. For our purposes, we will not imagine such a relationship. We are assuming that these two do not exclude each other, but coexist. By disregarding all relationships demanded by their inner nature, only their relationship as two separate entities remains. I can go from one to the other, and there is no doubt about the kind of connection that exists between the two. If I can pass from one thing to the other, and each remains completely unchanged in the process, the only connection between them must be in terms of space. Any other relationship would involve their qualitative differences. But space is indifferent to everything except the fact that they are separated. If I say A is on top and B is at the bottom, then it is a matter of indifference what A or B are. My only thought in connection with them is that they are two separate factors of the world presented to my senses. When our mind approaches experience, it wants to overcome all separation. It wants to show that the power of the whole is visible in the particular. When we look at the world spatially, the only thing we seek to overcome is this separation itself. We strive to establish the most universal connection. This spatial relationship establishes that A and B are not each a world of their own, that they have something in common. This is what spatial juxtaposition means. If each thing existed only for itself, there could be no spatial juxtaposition. I would be unable to make any sort of connection between things. Now let us see where this establishing of external relationships between separate entities leads us. There is only one way I can think of two elements in such a relationship. I can think of A as next to B. I can do the same with two additional elements of the sensory world, C and D. I have thus determined a concrete relationship between A and B, as well as between C and D. Now I can forget about the individual elements A, B, C, and D, and consider only the relationship between the two pairs. Clearly, I can relate these particular entities to one another in the same way as I did A and B. I am merely relating concrete relationships. I call these pairs small a and small b. But now I have lost track of all particularity. When I look at small a, I no longer see capital A and capital B in relation to each other, and similarly with small b. All I find in both cases is the simple fact that relationships have been established. But the relationship is the same in both cases. What enabled me to distinguish small a from small b was that they referred to capitals A, B, C, and D. If I abandon this vestige of particularity and relate only small a and small b, that is, the mere fact that they are relationships, not that specifics are related, I have again arrived quite generally at the spatial relationship from which I began. I can go no farther. I have achieved what I was striving for, an inner realization of space. Herein lies the secret of three-dimensionality. In the first dimension, I relate two concrete elements of the sensory world. In the second dimension, I establish a relationship between such spatial relationships, a relationship between relationships. The concrete phenomena have been eliminated, and all that remains are the concrete relationships. Now I bring these into spatial relationship, which means that I completely disregard the concrete nature of those relationships. I, therefore, find exactly the same thing in the one relationship that I found in the other. I establish relationships between like entities. Now the possibility of relating ceases, because all differences have disappeared. What I began with as a point of view for my investigation, a completely external relationship, I have now come back to, but this time as a sensory picture. Having performed the process indicated above three times, I have gone from taking a spatial point of view to space itself, that is, to my point of departure. This is why space must be three-dimensional. What I have shown here with regard to space is really only one particular example of our general method of observation. We observe concrete objects from a common point of view. In this way we gain concepts of particulars. We then observe these concepts themselves from the same perspective, so that we have concepts of concepts. If we connect them again, they fuse as an ideal unity that may be seen only in relation to itself. Let us take an example. I make the acquaintance of two people, A and B. I observe them from the perspective of friendship. In this case, I will have a very definite concept, small a, of the friendship of these two individuals. Next, I look at two other people, C and D, from the same viewpoint. I will have a different concept, small b, of their friendship. Now, I can proceed and place these two concepts of friendship side by side. What I am left with when I abstract from my concrete observations is the general concept of friendship itself. But this concept can also be achieved by observing the friendship of E and F from the same point of view, and later that of G and H. In these cases, as in countless others, I can arrive at the concept of friendship in general. Essentially, all these concepts are identical. And when I look at them from the same viewpoint, I realize that I have a unity. I am back where I started. Space, then, is a way of viewing things, a way for our mind to unite what is separate. The three dimensions function as follows. The first dimension establishes a connection between two sensory perceptions, parenthesis, sensations in Kant's terms, close parenthesis. It is a concrete mental image. The second dimension relates two concrete mental images to each other and enters the realm of abstraction. The third dimension only establishes the ideal unity of the two abstractions. Consequently, it is incorrect to think of the three dimensions of space as having the same significance. The nature of the first depends on the elements perceived, but the other two have a very specific and different meaning from the first. This is where Kant went wrong, thinking of space as a totality instead of as an entity that can in itself be conceptually defined. Up to this point, we have spoken of space as a relationship. We must now ask, is there only this relationship of juxtaposition, or does each thing have an absolute position? These questions have not been touched on at all by our considerations so far. But let us try to see whether there is such a thing as, quote, absolute location, close quote, or a specific, in quotes, there. What do I actually mean by there? I only refer to a specific object in immediate proximity to the object under consideration. There means in proximity to a designated object. In this way, absolute location is traced back to a spatial relationship, thus concluding our investigation. Let us now put the question directly. What is space according to our inquiry? It is the necessity inherent in all things to overcome their separation in a completely external way, without reference to their essential nature, thus bringing them together in a unity, albeit an external one. Space is therefore a way of apprehending the world as a unity. Space is an idea, not a perception, as Kant believed. Part 6, entitled Goethe, Newton, and the Physicists. Originally, Goethe's interest in observing the essential nature of color was artistic. His intuitive genius soon recognized that the use of color in painting adhered to a deep lawfulness. He was unable to discover the nature of that lawfulness as long as he remained within the limits of theories of painting. Nor were painters able to give him a satisfying answer. Painters knew in a practical way how to mix and use colors, but they were unable to conceptualize what they did. When Goethe went to Italy, he not only saw the most sublime examples of that art, but also the most magnificent colors of nature. And a powerful desire awakened in him to understand the laws of color. In his title History of Color Theory, Goethe gives a thorough account of historical aspects of the subject. Let us focus here on its psychological and factual aspects. Immediately after his return from Italy, Goethe began to study color. This intensified during 1790 and 1791 and remained a constant preoccupation of his until his death. Let us consider the state of Goethe's worldview when he began to study color. He had already developed his grand thought of the metamorphosis of organic entities. The discovery of the intermaxillary bone had already revealed the unity of all natural beings. The individual appeared to him as a particular modification of the idea. In his letters from Italy, he had expressed the notion that a plant is a plant because it carries within itself the, quote, idea of the plant, close quote. To him, that idea is a concrete unity filled with spiritual content and active in each plant. It cannot be seen with physical eyes, but can be apprehended with the eyes of the spirit. Those who see it in every plant. This makes the entire plant kingdom, and, by further elaboration of this view, all of nature, a unity that can be comprehended by the mind. But nobody can construct from the idea alone the multiplicity provided by our senses. The intuitive mind can know the idea, but the particular forms are accessible only when we direct our senses toward the outside, observing and contemplating. Why a modification of the idea takes one form and no other in the reality of our senses is a question whose answer cannot be found by intellectual speculations. We must look into the real world. This is Goethe's particular way of viewing things, which can best be described as empirical idealism. We may summarize it this way. When observing the multiplicity of things that arise for the senses, to the extent that those things are similar, we can find a spiritual unity at their foundation, which is the source of all their similarities. Thus Goethe came to ask, what is the spiritual unity behind the multiplicity of color perceptions? What do I perceive in every color? It quickly became clear to him that light was the necessary foundation of every color. No light, no color. Colors, however, are modifications of light. But now he had to find the element that modifies light and gives it specificity. He found that this element was lightless matter, or active darkness. In other words, that which opposes light. For him, therefore, each color was light modified by darkness. It is incorrect to assume that when speaking of light, Goethe meant concrete sunlight or the usual white light. The only real obstacle to an understanding of Goethe's color theory is the fact that people cannot let go of this notion, that they view sunlight with its complex composition as the representative of light as such. Light, as Goethe sees it, in its opposition to darkness, is a purely spiritual entity, common to all color sensations. Although he never said so explicitly, his whole theory of color is presented in such a way that there is no other way to understand it. When he tested his theory by experimenting with sunlight, he did this only because sunlight, although the product of complex processes in the body of the sun, nevertheless presents itself to us as a unity, whose parts are suspended within it. What we obtain for the color theory by observing sunlight merely approximates the reality. We should not think that Goethe's theory implies that light and darkness, as tangible realities, are actually contained in each color. The reality of what meets our eye is only a particular shade of color. Only the mind can separate this sensory fact of color into two spiritual entities, light and non-light. The outer conditions and physical processes involved in this are not in the least affected by what has just been described. They are a completely different matter. There is no doubt that there is an oscillation in the ether when red appears to me. But, as has been shown, see pages 172 and forward, the actual physical events involved in a perception have nothing to do with its essential nature. One may argue that all sensations have been proven to be subjective, and that aside from occurrences in our brain, only the wave processes behind the sensations actually exist. This would render it impossible to speak of any physical theory of perception, but only of a theory of those underlying physical processes. This proof is not unlike the following argument. If someone located in small A sends a telegram to me in small B, the telegram I receive into my hands originated in small B. The telegrapher is in small B. He writes on a paper that never was in small A, using ink that never was in small A, and may not have any clue about where small A actually is. In other words, it can be proven that what I have in front of my eyes did not originate in small A at all. And yet all these things that originated in small B are completely indifferent to the actual content or essence of the telegram. The thing that matters to me was simply mediated through small b. If I wish to explain the meaning of the telegram, I must completely disregard what happened in small b. The same is true of the eye, Eye. Theory must encompass what is perceptible by the eye and look for interrelationships within this realm. Material processes in space and time may be very important for the occurrence of perceptions, but they have no relation to their essential nature. This also applies to a question that is frequently asked today about whether the various natural phenomena of light, warmth, electricity, and so on are all caused by the same wave process in the ether. Heinrich Hertz, 1857 to 1894, proved recently that electrical effects in space obey the same laws as the effects of light. One may infer from this that the waves that carry light also underlie electricity. It was already accepted that only one kind of vibration is active in the spectrum of sunlight, which produces warmth, light, or chemical effects, depending on whether the reagents they contact are sensitive to heat, light, or chemical action. All this goes without saying. If we investigate what happens in space, while the entities under consideration are being mediated, we will find a uniform motion. In a medium where only motion is possible, any response to stimuli must be through motion. Any mediation that it carries out will be conducted in the form of motion. If I subsequently investigate the forms of this motion, I will not experience the nature of what is communicated, but only the way it is delivered to me. It is absurd to claim that warmth or light are motions. Motion is simply the response of matter capable of movement when it encounters light. Goethe himself lived to see the birth of the wave theory, and he saw nothing in it that did not agree with his own convictions about the nature of color. We must let go of the idea that Goethe conceived of light and darkness as sense-perceptible realities, and instead think of them only as principles, as spiritual entities. Then we will see his color theory in an entirely new light. If, like Newton, we see light as merely a mixture of all the colors, we lose any conception of, in quotes, light as a concrete entity. It evaporates into an empty generalization that has no correspondence to reality at all. Such abstract concepts were alien to Goethe. According to him, every concept had to have concrete content, but for him, concrete was not limited to the physical. In reality, contemporary physics has no concept for light. It recognizes specific lights or colors that in certain combinations create the sensation white. But this white cannot be considered the same as light. In fact, white is also a mixed color. Light in the Goethean sense is foreign to conventional physics, as is darkness. Goethe's theory of color moves in a realm untouched by the concepts of physicists who know nothing of the fundamental concepts of Goethe's theory of color. It is therefore impossible for them to assess his theory, for Goethe begins where they end. The constant talk about Goethe's relationship to Newton and to modern physics is based on a very superficial understanding of the issues that completely overlooks the fact that they are two entirely different things. We are convinced that if one correctly understands our discussion of the nature of sensations, one will also share the view of Goethe's color theory that has been presented here. But if one does not accept our fundamental theories, one will have to maintain the viewpoint of physical optics and reject Goethe's theory of color altogether. The end of chapter 16.